The discovery which impelled me to write this book is one I believe to be of extraordinary importance. The 7 cases : stressed in these pages involve abductions of 5 different individuals. 3, who incidentally have never met, were taken as 7-year-old children, and incisions were made in their bodies, for whatever purposes we can only speculate. 2 of them, and possibly all 3, were apparently abducted a second time, one at age 16, one a few years later. All 3 were born in 1943, and were abducted in the summer of 1950. None of them had, to hypnotic regression, any recall whatsoever of a UFO or encounter of any kind. How they happened to undergo hypnosis in the first place involves a complex series of unlikely ... events, which I shall describe in later chapters. Each case is in some way intertwined with another involving a young man who was abducted in his early 20s, but who, like the others, had absolutely no conscious memory of a UFO sighting. All that he had to go on was the feeling that something may have happened to him one night in 1973, on a particular road in Maryland, as he drove home from his girlfriend's house. Hypnosis revealed a classic abduction. An inescapable conclusion to be drawn from all these cases is that anyone could have been abducted, with no memory of it, no conscious recall even of a preliminary event like the sighting of a UFO. It could have happened to any one of us years ago, in childhood, or recently. No signs or clues may necessarily have remained. This, to me, is the most dramatic and disturbing possibility that has yet taken shape in all the years of UFO research. And yet what it finally means is as mysterious as ever. For all any of us knows, the whole UFO phenomenon may be ultimately, blissfully benign. There is firm evidence for this position, and so having been abducted may turn out to have been a peculiar privilege. No one knows. All I can say is that I'm sure it is going on. People are being picked up, examined, sometimes marked for life, and released, their memories conveniently blocked. Beyond this, everything is speculation. Headline: Cape Cod Genesis. How I, a rational, peace loving artist, ever became involved in something so esoteric as the UFO phenomenon is something I'm really not sure of myself, though one thing is clear: events came to me, L didn't seek them out, in the beginning, at least. I was in high school and college during the late 40s and early 50s when the first flying saucer accounts appeared in the newspapers. I was not particularly interested at the time, and I remember barely paying attention to them. By the middle 60s, the subject of UFOs, so far as I knew, had completely receded from view, having been explained away by the Air Force investigators during the past decade. Big weather balloons or hallucinations or something or other had definitely caused all this mistaken excitement. I was living in Truro, Massachusetts, in the summer of 1964 in our recently constructed summer studio, and my first wife Joan and I were entertaining a house guest, Ted Rotten, an English social worker we had met on a European trip. Provincetown, Truro and Wellfleet constitute a vital summer art colony, and there is an endless procession of openings, cocktail parties, and sundry cultural and social events. On a late August afternoon, Joan, Ted, and I set out from Truro, heading to Provincetown for a cocktail party. It was about 5:30 and the cloud masses from an earlier storm had broken up. Small clumps of clouds blew quickly in from the ocean as we drove along Route 6. One of us, I do not remember who, remarked upon a darkish, elliptical object in the sky off to our left and ahead of the car. It was small, 2 car lengths long one might judge, and it did not seem to be moving. A cloud cluster approached it, floated in front of it, and obscured it from view. In seconds, the cloud passed by and there was our elliptical object again, still apparently in the same place, picking up a strong beam of temporary sunlight and appearing to be dull aluminium in color. Another cloud mass scudded behind it, silhouetting it for a moment. What could it be? We were intrigued. I slowed the car as we came closer to it, and now we were looking up at it at a steeper angle. It appeared to be circular when viewed more or less from underneath. At one point, it was swallowed up by another fast, moving cloudlet which apparently was of little substance. One could see a round object inside the cloud with all local color eliminated, and thereby appearing as black, like a ship in a fog bank. By this time, perhaps a minute and a half or so after we had first seen it, we were all three speculating. Is it a balloon? Someone wondered. If it is, it's tied to the ground, I said, since it's not going anywhere and the wind is whipping the clouds along. It was definitely not a helicopter. There were no wings, no tail, no appendages of any kind, just a smooth circle seen from below, and a somewhat elliptical shape in profile. By now, we had passed it. I was driving very slowly and we were craning our necks to keep it in sight. Suddenly it moved off, crossing the road behind us, heading for the ocean against the wind. I stopped the car and we all jumped out and watched it silently disappear into the clouds that were blowing in from the northeast. It moved at the speed of, say, a small airplane. We were stunned, confused, and then excited. What was it? One of us, I forget who, said, "Do you suppose that was one of those flying saucers you used to read about?" We went to the party, at Hudson and Lone Walker's, and told about our adventure. One of the guests said that she had, the summer previously, seen a very similar object do very similar things at just about the same place along Route 6. Several other people had stories of their own. Intrigued, I began to look into the matter of UFOs, and was soon made aware, from a book I bought on the subject, that the situation was far from being resolved, that it was, in fact, a perplexing and ongoing mystery. An odd but very human reaction one has to such mysteries is to be able to accept as plausible only what strange thing one has personally experienced, and nothing further. I read accounts in these UFO books of sightings like mine, very believable, I thought. But then Look magazine published an account of the Betty and Cape Coogenesis, Barney Hill abduction, from John Fuller's book, length study of this first widely publicized kidnapping by UFO occupants. One ridiculous, I thought. Who can believe such foolishness? My logic remained unexamined. I accepted the possibility that what I saw over Route 6 might be some kind of spacecraft. Some kind of extraterrestrial probe of our environment. After all, most scientists accept the idea of extraterrestrial intelligence as probable, so such eventual explorations would seem to be at least possible. I even vaguely admitted the possibility that there might have been some sort of living beings inside this possible spacecraft, but that they landed, and stopped a car, and kidnapped two people, and administered some sort of physical examination, and took skin and blood samples, and so on? Ridiculous. I continued to follow the UFO reports through newspaper articles and occasional paperback books, my interest stabilized on what I thought was a somewhat casual level. The painter's life does not easily allow for multiple obsessions. The actor Maximilian Sell acquired a 1968 painting of mine, Genesis I, which contained, as most of my work did in those years, a huge, ambiguous black circle. He remarked that there was something unearthly about the painting and suggested that I should go see Stanley Kubrick's film 2001, because he felt some kind of resonance between the two works. I disagreed with him after I saw the movie, but in retrospect I may have underestimated at the time the degree of my absorption in the UFO phenomenon. The subconscious is a busy place. It took 3 or 4 years for me slowly to admit to myself the possibility that the Betty and Barney Hill abduction just might have happened exactly as the Hills recalled through hypnosis. They had not, after all, initially claimed anything about an abduction. They had had a nighttime UFO sighting in 1961 on a remote highway in New Hampshire, and sensed that there were about 2 hours they could not account for on their drive home. Barney Hill began to have nightmares and to suffer from a recurrent ulcer. He went to a psychiatrist for help, and since some kind of hidden trauma seemed to be part of the problem, he entered into hypnosis. Out came a traumatic abduction by UFO occupants. Betty Hill also underwent regressive hypnosis without knowing any of the content of her husband's sessions. Dr. Benjamin Simon, the Hills' psychiatrist, gave both of his patients post-hypnotic suggestions that they would not remember what had transpired during their respective trance periods. Dr. Simon Tape recorded the sessions, however, and was struck by the similarity of their descriptions, of their humanoid captors, of the inside of the ship, of the circumstances of their kidnapping, and so on. As I read about the case in detail - finally bought Fuller's book, The Interrupted Journey - began to feel that the Hills were recalling precisely what had happened to them, and the fact that it emerged the way it did, under hypnosis, in two separate accounts, gave it unusual validity. If the UFOs were some kind of spacecraft piloted, if that's the word, by extraterrestrials, perhaps they might be exploring very cautiously, giving us a good long look, picking up samples under very safe conditions, really studying us at long range before landing and establishing contact. After all, it was rather puerile and anthropomorphic of us to expect aliens to behave as we had, landing on the moon, jumping out and sticking a little American flag, wired stiff for TV, pole first into the lunar dust, and then posing for pictures in front of it. Surreptitious examinations such as those conducted on Betty and Barney Hill made a great deal of sense, especially when contrasted with the foolish landing on their White House lawn. Take us to your leader concept of what we should expect. Years later, I heard Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the astronaut who walked on the moon during the second landing, explain his position. If we had expected to encounter any kind of living beings, which, of course, we didn't, we would naturally have asked NASA to put us down in some very unpopulated region where we could examine the local fauna in safety and at our discretion. We would have wanted to pick up some living specimens, examine them, and put them back with a minimum of fuss, hoping to get back to Earth safely with as much information as possible. By the time the Pascagoula abduction occurred in 1973-3, I was able to accept the idea of human sample, taking as quite plausible, within the context of the thousands of worldwide UFO sightings. The crucial reason for my ability to accept these accounts as true was the central issue. If these events did not occur as reported by the witnesses, then what caused their recollections? Many abductees have voluntarily submitted to polygraph examinations and voice stress analysis, the two most common lie detection methods, so far as I know. No case reaching the level of investigation in which these devices were introduced has turned out to be a hoax. Clearly, the witnesses believe they are telling the truth. Then what happened? How can so many normal people with no discernible psychological disabilities have hallucinated in such elaborate corroborative detail, particularly when these very similar hallucinations usually emerge through regressive hypnosis? Not even Jung would have claimed archetypes to be so finely honed, nor so consonant. Over the years, friends began to pass on to me various UFO sightings of their own, and I began to take notes when they were of sufficient interest. Occasionally, during the later 60s and early 70s, I would bring the matter up at a dinner party and would almost never fail to elicit another report. Being an artist gave me a certain freedom to introduce such a peculiar subject. One can hardly imagine a neurosurgeon, an investment broker, or a psychiatrist admitting in public to a serious interest in UFOs in those years. The freedom an artist has is both an essential working condition and his greatest fringe benefit. He, or she, can keep the salacious novel out on the bed table while the lawyer has it buried in his shirt drawer. The curiosity might be the same, but there is a different attitude toward concealment. The summer of 1975 was a crucial one for my interest in the UFO phenomenon. A series of sightings in the Truro, Wellfleet Provincetown area came to my attention, and I began a slightly more intensified investigation into each one. Betty Bodian, a painter friend of mine, reported a strange white globe in the twilight sky over Provincetown Harbor. This glowing object, which appeared to be stationary, blinked on and off irregularly for about 3 minutes before it vanished. I was not particularly interested until Dan and Jan Boynton, then CEO, owners of the Provincetown Advocate, told me they had seen a glowing white light blinking oddly over the bay, and I learned that the time, location, and July 16 date were the same as the former report. The interesting thing was that the Boyntons were at a location 90 degrees away from Miss Bodin, separated by a distance of about 3 miles. Also very interesting was a human side issue. The Boyntons personally wrote some of the copy for their paper, Dan was the editor and Jan took most of the photographs. They saw the UFO while driving in Truro on Route 6, the same location, incidentally, where I had had my sighting years earlier, and carried on the back seat of the car all their camera gear. So two newspaper owners, editors, writers, photographers spent 2 minutes or so discussing this odd thing in the sky without ever stopping a moment to photograph it, an example, perhaps, of why there are fewer UFO photographs than one might expect. Subsequently, 4 more witnesses to this UFO turned up, located at different places along a 5-mile stretch. One of them, using binoculars, was sure she observed a row of what seemed like windows inside the glowing shape. This particular UFO, if indeed there was only one, turned out to be very busy, for a while almost ubiquitous. Within the 6-week period from late June into August, an object fitting its description was seen on many occasions by 1, 2 Wellfleet police officers, who watched it moving through the sky around 3 a.m. on July 3rd, 2, by a woman and her teen-aged daughter, who saw it west of Provincetown hovering and blinking, 3, on July 17th, by a man in East Ham, a town near Wellfleet, who called the Coast Guard in the belief it was some kind of distress signal, and 4, most interesting of all, by David Lidd and Bess Schuyler, near their property in Truro. They had returned home about 11:30 p.m. on a warm, foggy night August 12, when they saw, as they approached their house, what they took at first to be a fire below the top of a hill about a quarter of a mile away. They realized in seconds that it was not a fire but was, instead, a large circular light either resting on, or slightly above, the ground. David found his binoculars and through the fog the globe seemed to contain windows, or vertical sections of some sort, like a southern mansion with columns, in his words. The next day we found that a split rail fence was located nearby, and if the object had been behind it, the slats could have caused this illusion. David also noticed that from time to time the big light gave off individual beams of light, shining out from its circumference. Though the sight was most unusual, David and Bess decided in the darkness that it must be a house that they had never noticed before. Perhaps a neighbor had cut down some foliage which had screened his dwelling from view, or perhaps had installed a huge new floodlight of some sort that was being enlarged by the fog. There must be some explanation like that, so they put away the binoculars and retired. I share a small house in New York with Bess and David, and know them very well. Bess is curious about the UFO phenomenon and David is rather skeptical, or in the very least, uninterested. In the morning, Bess called to tell me about it and to apologize for not alerting me the night before. She had awakened early and had gone outside with her binoculars. Because of the nature of the shoreline and the location of the little hill, the light could only have been in one specific place, and Bess quickly realized that there was no house near that spot, just low ground cover, what is called on the Cape hog cranberry, and scrub pine. There are 2 houses in the general vicinity, one of which had been for years the summer residence of Edward Hopper, the great American painter, but on the night before both houses were lit and visible. Somewhere between them there had been a large, unknown light, emitting beams, and apparently very close to the ground, if not resting on it. I drove over to see what I could find, and in minutes uncovered something else. Bess remained on her deck in the spot where she and David had watched the light, and I moved out towards the hill. Bess waved her arm to the left or right, steering me to the site, and as I walked along I saw a car approach. a woman and a teen, aged girl drove up to the cottage and stopped. They were the summer tenants in the house closest to the critical spot, so I asked them about the incident after explaining what I was doing. Unfortunately, the night before the mother had retired very early and was asleep by 11:30, her daughter, and a son who was soon to join us, had been in Provincetown that night until 1 a.m., and so they, too, had not seen anything unusual. But I noticed that all three exchanged quick, meaningful glances. "Did anyone see anything peculiar 3 nights ago?" the woman asked, and then told me her story. It had been a Saturday night and for some reason she couldn't fall asleep, so she decided to read. Around 1:30 in the morning, a light began to shine in her bedroom window, a very bright, moving light, whose source was apparently high enough not to be visible. The light streamed in, passing rather quickly and moving towards the bay. It was very bright, white, and very odd, she thought. The area is quite isolated and she was alarmed. Instead of going to her window, which faced roughly south, she went to the stairs and called to her daughter, whose room on the floor above faced west. The daughter awakened in time to see the light stream in her windows and pass by, heading north, as if circling the house. Again no light source could be seen. Wide awake now, and curious, the girl came downstairs to her mother's room, just in time to see the light come by again, this time reversing its earlier path to run counter-clockwise. And that was that. None of the family of three had any idea what it could have been. It was soundless. The Cape is a very quiet place. Noise of any sort carries great distances, and neighbors claim they hear each other turn on the lights. My only theory was that automobile headlights from a car driving on the dirt road that leads to the Hopper House might somehow have been the cause, though it looked unlikely because a ridge intervenes between road and house. Nevertheless, I decided to experiment. Late that night, I returned in my car. The family retired to their rooms, set the lights as they were that evening, and I took to the wheel. I drove forward, stopped, backed up, turned around, flicked from high to low beams, in fact, did everything but drive straight into the sand. They never saw a flicker from my car. The ridge, as I suspected, blocked everything. Within the week, I learned about a third incident close to the Lid, Schuyler House. In late June, a psychotherapist and his wife, whose home is located about 3/4 of a mile away, had been napping in their bedroom after dinner. They awakened and noticed what they took to be the full moon shining low in the sky, until they realized that the moon was not full at the time, and besides, was not visible in that location. They told me weeks later that the incident had been vaguely unnerving, so without saying anything much about it, they had gone into the front of their house to brew some coffee. The moon was visible from the living room windows. They had their coffee and dawdled a bit, and then returned to their bedroom. Both of them glancing casually toward the sky, the globe of light was still where it had been. Neither remarked to the other about it, but both decided to go back to the living room. After a second uneasy wait, which again was deliberately not discussed, they went back to their bedroom, saw the peculiar light, and once more found an excuse to visit the living room. They passed the time in casual, unrelated conversation, and eventually wandered back to their bedroom for the third time. The light was no longer there and, much relieved, they retired for the night. They admitted to me that neither mentioned the incident to the other the next morning, nor, for that matter, ever, until they had heard about the strange curio light from some friends of theirs, who also told them of my interest. In retrospect, they found their behavior at the time very interesting. Out of sight, out of mind, had been buttressed by out of conversation, out of existence. To have discussed the matter would have been to admit a presence they knew to be unsettling and genuinely mysterious. Gapesiogenesis, the writer Donald Barthelme said to me once after he had read an account of a UFO landing I had written for the Village Voice that his life was complicated enough not to have to add this issue to the things he had to worry about. He was sorry he'd read the piece in the first place. I know what he means. I certainly never wanted to deal with the UFO problem, a phenomenon that until that 1964 August afternoon on the road to Provincetown I didn't even know existed. I have deliberately skimmed over these 1975 Cape Cod sightings, not because they aren't interesting in themselves, but because they are far down on the list of cases which warrant thorough investigation, and at the time they occurred I was just beginning to pursue the subject actively. A few months after I returned to New York, everything changed when, one November evening, George Obarski told me about his experience in North Hudson Park. But this, at least, tells how my interest in the UFO phenomenon began. Next headline: the landing in North Hudson Park. Across the street from my studio in the Chelsea district of Manhattan, there is a small liquor store. It is typical of hundreds just like it, physically undistinguished, but open 14 or 15 hours every day, and a regular neighborhood stopping, off place, like the dry cleaners or the supermarket. The owners are Bill Burns and George Obarski, and they have been selling me my dinner wine and doing emergency check cashing for me for over 20 years. In November of 1975, George Obarski was 72 years old. He is street, wise, astute, and reflective, an essential set of qualities for New Yorkers, and he is also a strict teetotaler. On a particular late November evening, I came into his store to buy a bottle of Sauve to have with supper. George was pacing back and forth behind the counter, obviously troubled. He began complaining about an arthritic pain in his knee, and then muttered something to me about how you didn't know any more what might happen. Middle-pen. A man can be driving home, minding his own business, and something can come down out of the sky and scare you half to death. Naturally, I stopped him there. What do you mean, something can come down out of the sky? Slowly and reluctantly, he began to tell me the story, and he continued only because I assured him I was seriously interested in what had happened to him. Two or three other customers entered the store and caused lengthy interruptions, so I told George I'd be back after dinner to hear the rest of his adventure. He had no idea, I realized, that I was interested in things that come down out of sky, so his hesitation to expose himself to ridicule was natural. And his story was all but incredible. An hour or so later, I was back in the store with my cassette colon tape recorder, and George cautiously began to unburden himself. The incident had happened 10 months previously, in the middle colon of January. George had closed the store at midnight, walked Cognac, his German Shepherd guard dog, and had then worked on his bookkeeping and shelf replenishing. Around 1 or 2 a.m., he locked up and started for home in his black Chevrolet. George lives in North Bergen, New Jersey, just across the Hudson River from Manhattan. That night, according to habit, he was driving through deserted North Hudson Park on his way to a 24-hour diner in Fort Lee. His car radio began to pick up static and sound tinny, and, as he fumbled with the dial, muttering at the prospect of another costly repair, a low, brilliantly lit object passed his car 100 feet or so on the left, traveling in the same direction. It was a warm night, George remembered, and the window was partway down on the driver's side. He heard a quiet humming or droning sound coming from the craft, which now had stopped in a playing field ahead of his car. Proceeding very slowly and feeling totally bewildered by what he was seeing, George drew closer to the roundish, 30-foot-long ship, which now was hovering about 10 feet above the ground. It was circumscribed by a series of regularly spaced vertical windows, roughly 1 foot wide by 4 feet high. George looked on in stunned disbelief as a narrow panel opened between two windows and a ladder-like apparatus emerged. The ship settled to within 4 feet of the playing field, and immediately a group of small figures appeared and, one after the other, descended to the ground. George estimates that they were only 3.5 to 4 feet tall, and they were clad in identical helmeted, or hooded, one-piece light, colored garments. They looked like kids in snowsuits, he recalled. There were at least 9 and possibly 10 or 11 of them, he was too shocked to count, but he could not make out their faces.